From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the Affordable Care Act has managed to cut the number of uninsured Americans by 11 million in 5 years, but the debate over the law hasn't changed all that much.
But right now, let's go to the latest on the investigation into why Germanwings Flight 9525 crashed into the French Alps on Tuesday. The chief French prosecutor involved in that investigation said today that the co-pilot brought the plane down intentionally. On the black box voice recorder, investigators can hear the captain leave the cockpit and then apparently get locked outside. He pounds on the door, but there's no response from inside the cockpit, just the sound of the co-pilot breathing normally in the moments before the crash. Friends of the 28-year-old German co-pilot reject the prosecutor's conclusion, saying it's too early to know what happened. William Langavisha is an international correspondent for Vanity Fair with extensive experience covering airplane crashes. He's with us from New York. William, welcome.
Thank you.
And the chief French prosecutor handling the investigation would not label this suicide, but in this morning's press conference, translated here by CNN, he said he could not otherwise explain why the co-pilot brought the plane steadily down directly into the mountainside.
He had no reason to do so. He had no reason to stop his captain from returning to the cockpit. He had no reason not to answer the air traffic control, which was telling him about loss of altitude.
William, what do you make of this, the prosecutor at this stage of the investigation saying that the co-pilot brought this plane down intentionally?
Well, I think it's, you know, he may be right. He may well be right, but it seems to me to be premature. You know, there are different systems in place in the world for investigating accidents, and the French system is an extremely good one. It probably is not my preferred one. The prosecution, it's a parallel investigation, so there's a criminal investigation always because of the deaths in France, to the technical investigation, which is done by the famous BEA, the real accident investigators. The BEA, I think, would not be making statements like this so early, and I think that, again, he may be right, but it's sort of the voice of inexperience speaking here when it comes to dealing with information at an early stage of an investigation.
Well, if he is right, though, and the pilot, after leaving the cockpit, was trying to get back in and was unable to get back in because the door to the cockpit was locked and the other pilot who was at the controls would not open it, the question that has come up is, was there an overcorrection after 9/11 when these cockpit doors became more secure and harder to get into? Should there be a way for a pilot who leaves to get back in without the person on the inside of the cockpit allowing them in?
I think that, you know, there's always a cost for every benefit. We clearly needed to fortify the doors after 9/11. And lock them, and we did. The American system is to, you know, require some other crew member to be in the cockpit if one of the pilots leaves. The Europeans don't have that system in place, and I'm sure they're going to put it in place now. But it's probably an easier solution than a mechanical solution. We know from experience that, you know, if a pilot wants to take an airplane down, the time he does it is when the other guy goes to the head, when he leaves to relieve himself. That's when things happen. A pilot left alone in the cockpit is probably not a good idea.
And when you say we know from experience, you're talking probably about the Egypt Air Flight 990 crash that back in 1999 off the coast of Nantucket. U.S. officials determined that one of the pilots on that flight crashed it intentionally into the water.
Yes, that was the determination. The Egyptians resisted it strongly, and I think probably still resist it today, that determination. But in fact, that is what happened. It became very political, which is rare for accident investigations. But in this case, because we're dealing with Egyptian sensibilities, pretty much anything went wrong except that their own man did it. Well, their own man did do it, and that's what the NTSB investigation conclusively demonstrated.
And is there a connection, do you think, at this point between what happened there and what happened here? Do you take any lessons from that crash in this case?
Again, it's premature, and we don't know. I mean, I in the back of my mind, I still have very much an open mind toward the possibility of a medical crisis here. I mean, it does seem a little unlikely because, you know, the level flight was deselected. But I frankly think this is too early to speculate. The investigation has to continue at least a few more days, if not a few more weeks.
One of the other things, though, that has come up is how much screening there is for pilots, both health screening in case this was some sort of a medical emergency and also psychological screening. What is the case right now when it comes to that?
Well, there is some screening, of course. There is screening of various kinds, including, you know, criminal checks and psychological checks, technical skills, all of that, references. There's only so much you can do with this. You know, it obviously, if you find a person is a member of an extremist political group, you probably won't hire him as a pilot. But it's very difficult to predict. As we know in normal life, it's very difficult to predict the sudden, irrational, and potentially violent moves of individuals. And we just, you know, we're not there. And maybe thank God we're not there. Because if we try to do it, we'd probably be making a lot of mistakes. Wrongful conviction, if you know what I mean.
William Longavisha, international correspondent with Vanity Fair, talking with us about the latest on the German Wings crash in France. Thank you, William.
Thank you.
Obamacare is 5 years old, and according to President Obama, it's healthy and well.
It's making healthcare coverage more affordable and more effective for all of us. And in a lot of ways, it's working better than many of us, including me, anticipated.
Now, it's no surprise that he touted the Affordable Care Act as he spoke yesterday at the White House. But detractors say the act still has serious issues. In fact, the debate in Congress to repeal the law sounds just as it did in 2010. Julie Rovner is a senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. She's been reporting on the ACA since before it was signed into law. So, Julie, at age five, what exactly has the law accomplished?
Well, as the president pointed out, some things about the law are working very well. Millions of people, we don't know exactly how many, but somewhere between 10 and 16 million more people now have coverage than they did 5 years ago. Medical inflation has slowed. We're not sure how much of that is due to the law, how much of it is due to the recession, and how much is something experts haven't figured out yet. Millions of people who literally couldn't buy insurance before the law can now buy it if they have pre-existing conditions. And there are some small millions of numbers of young adults who are now remaining on their parents' health plans as a result of the law.
Okay, but there are drawbacks, too. As we hear quite a bit in Congress, in fact, as we mentioned, Republicans continue to try to repeal the law. The U.S. Supreme Court has been looking into it as well. Would you give us an update and kind of a roundup of the repeal efforts and whether or not any of them has traction?
Yes, well, of course, the Republicans who never liked the law now would still like to repeal it. There are certainly problems with the law. One of the big ones is because the law lays out the types of benefits that have to be covered in these plans that people buy, the way insurers have kept them sort of less expensive is to have very high out-of-pocket costs. So people will have multi-$1,000 deductibles or high copayments. That's been a problem. People buying benefits they don't necessarily want. The exchanges, which obviously are working better than they did at the beginning, still have their glitches here and there. So there are things to complain about. Then, of course, there's this Supreme Court case, which is kind of separate, and that's a charge that the federal government is not permitted to provide these tax credits to people in the federal exchange. Well, the federal exchange is more than three-quarters of the states. So that if the Supreme Court were to agree with the plaintiffs in that case, then an awful lot of people would lose their tax credits. Once they lose their tax credits, they would probably no longer be able to afford health insurance. So now, as we mentioned, that sick people can buy health insurance. Those sick people would probably want to hang on to their insurance. The healthy people, for whom it's gotten very expensive, would drop it, and you could have big messes in those many states in their individual insurance markets.
And when do we expect to hear back from the Supreme Court on this?
Sometime in June, probably the very end of June.
Okay. One other thing that's happening now, it is tax season, of course. This is the first year, though, that millions of Americans are going to have to think about the health care law as it relates to their taxes. There are some people who are going to be paying a penalty for being uninsured. There are some who are paying the difference on subsidies they got to buy insurance in the first place. How do you think these issues could influence how Americans think about the ACA?
Well, this first tax season was always expected to be a little bit messy. It was not helped by the fact that the federal government sent out something around 800,000 forms with incorrect information in them. They say that as of this week, everybody has the correct information. Now, for the vast majority of people who get insurance at work, they just have to check a box that says, I had insurance last year. But if you bought your own insurance, particularly if you bought it on the exchange, particularly if you got a tax credit, there's a very complicated form that you have to go through. As you mentioned, there is a reconciliation process. H&R Block is reporting that about half the people are having to pay back at least some of those tax credits because they underestimated their income for last year. About a third of people are getting a bigger tax credit, so they're getting money back. It's important to know that the federal government can't come after you for not paying the penalty for not having insurance, but they can come after you for all of the money that you owe if you got too much in the way of tax credits.
Okay. Thank you. Julie Roffner, senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, talking to us about Obamacare at age 5. Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
It's here and now. People in parts of Oklahoma are assessing damage today after a series of dangerous tornadoes. One person was killed and several were injured. More than 75,000 people across the state are without power, and at least 10 public schools are closed. The first of several tornadoes was spotted near Tulsa. Another touched down in the Oklahoma City suburb of Moore. Moore is where we find Gary McManus, the state climatologist at the Oklahoma Climatological Survey. Gary, welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And I understand you're home from work today, taking care of your kids because school there is closed because of the tornado. How much damage is there in Moore?
Well, in a certain area over in Central Moore, there's considerable damage, including damage to Southgate Elementary School. The roof was torn off and damage was done to that neighborhood. So that school is closed, and so the school administration in Moore decided to close schools today across the district so that they could assess the damage, drive the neighborhoods, make sure no damage was done to those schools or those families' homes.
And thankfully, there were no fatalities in Moore this time around. We, of course, remember that back in 2013, a tornado there killed 24 people. Moore was also hit in 2003 by a serious tornado and back in 1999 by an EF5 tornado. Is there something about the topography of Moore that makes it a prime target for tornadoes as severe weather rolls through Oklahoma?
Well, as a resident here, I'm kind of wondering that. Now, scientifically, we can't speak to anything certainly or in certainty, but right now we just chalk it up to bad luck. But that's not to say that there's nothing scientifically that can be proven later. That's very interesting, though.
Well, I grew up in central Illinois in a city that usually the tornadoes tended to skirt around, and everybody said that was because we were in a ditch and that the tornadoes would either bounce over us or go around. And
Oh, yes.
Is that true? Does that happen?
No, that's very, there are all sorts of those types of myths around the country, from everything from mountains to rivers to even Indian burial grounds, protecting certain areas, places in valleys. A tornado that struck Moore in 2013 traveled over a river. So all of those things just end up making people way too complacent about their danger. So it's very important to realize that tornadoes can go over just about any terrain, mountains, rivers. They don't care what they're going over. They just care that they're on the ground and destroying things.
Ironically, yesterday's tornado comes on the anniversary of a historic tornado in 1948. And people are saying that it was the tornado that had the first tornado warning. Tell us about that tornado.
More of a tornado forecast. 5 days previous to that, on March 20th, 1948, a tornado went through Tinker Air Force Base in central Oklahoma and did significant damage, destroyed a lot of planes, not a lot of structures, but a lot of planes were out on the runways. And so the Air Force said, you know, we need to be able to protect not only our personnel, but also our infrastructure and things like that. So they set out to try and develop this system to forecast tornadoes. And what they had at the time, of course, were previous atmospheric conditions during other tornadic outbreaks. And that's what Fawbush and Miller, the military personnel, did at the time, was they started to study all those previous conditions and could they, you know, look at the conditions in the current time and say, well, this might be a prime opportunity to issue a tornado forecast. Now, it just happens that 5 days later, they saw the same types of conditions start to develop, and then they said there could be severe thunderstorms or strong thunderstorms later that evening.
Well, and of course, now we use radar and satellite data to help us figure out if there's going to be a tornado. But how important was that very first tornado forecast in predicting future tornadoes?
Well, it got the ball rolling. You know, previous, it's very odd. Previous to that, at least for decades and decades, the word tornado was banned because it was thought to be, you know, like a screaming fire in a theater. So, you know, previous to that, just a few years, they finally decided after the tri-state tornado in the 20s and other big tornadic outbreaks that we don't need to be scared of the word tornado. We need to be scared of tornadoes. So the fact that Fawbush and Miller were successful in actually predicting the conditions for this tornado to strike, you know, I think part of it was actually luck because, you know, even today forecasting tornadoes has a little bit of luck to it, but it really got the science rolling on let's really start to look at this now. Let's start to try and advance the science. And that's really, you know, what it takes to have some sort of scientific advancement is the effort, but it's also just a little bit of luck involved.
That's Gary McManus, the state climatologist at the Oklahoma Climatological Survey, joining us from his home in Moore. He's there with his kids because they're out of school today because of the tornado that struck Moore yesterday. Gary, thanks so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, this Saturday, voters will go to the polls in Nigeria. And for the first time since the military handed over power to civilian authorities in 1999, an opposition candidate has a realistic chance of winning the presidency. The elections were scheduled for February, but were delayed when the government announced it was launching a campaign against Boko Haram, the militant Islamist group. I spoke with Darren Q earlier this week. He's part of a team monitoring the elections in Nigeria. And I asked him how Nigeria's religious breakdown, roughly half Muslim, half Christian, is affecting the election.
Unfortunately, from an identity conflict perspective, the way that the presidential tickets are lining up is that we have a northern Muslim leader heading the opposition on the one hand, and we have a southern Christian minority leader is the president of the country right now heading up the ruling party. Mm-hmm. And so this is aggravating the Muslim-Christian divide all across the country. So many of the states in what's called the Middle Belt that are divided by religion are going to be very, very contentious. And so consequently, I'm very, very worried about increasing levels of violence over the course of the election. The one thing that Nigeria needs as a democracy is the rise of a viable political opposition, but it's also the one thing that can burn the house down because ruling parties do not give up easily anywhere, not just in Africa, but other parts of the world.
Well, what exactly will you be doing when it comes to monitoring the election?
I'll be an observer, which means that my role is to simply keep track of the election process itself. We'll be breaking up into teams of two persons going to various states across Nigeria and going from polling station to polling station, watching what's happening and trying to get a sense of the picture in that state. And then all the teams come back to the capital. And then together we see what we're looking at, what sort of patterns we see. And then together we will put out a statement giving some sort of commentary on what the picture looks like.
This is the fifth time that you will be doing this in Nigeria. What have been some of the challenges in the past that you found?
Nigeria has a real problem in that it has a very complicated electoral process so that when votes are tallied at the polling station, they then go to the ward level, then to the local government, then to the state, and then to the federal. And at each one of these levels, it opens opportunities for local political machines to try to change those numbers. And this is exactly what we've seen in years past, is that we'll see a good process perhaps at the polling station itself. And then for security reasons, we are not allowed to be out during the night. And then when those numbers go to the local government area at the night, we may see them change overnight such that in the morning we start seeing totals that don't correlate with what we saw at the polling stations themselves.
And what do you do about that?
So as observers, again, all we can do is we can say, look, these numbers don't look like what we saw the day before, and we raise some questions so that Nigerian parties themselves can say, look, even the international observers have some concerns about this. We need to take a second look.
How is an election in Nigeria different from one in the United States? Does it feel the same? You go in, you punch your ballot or do the voting on a touch screen, or how does it work?
Typically, it's done a little bit differently. They use indelible ink, and you go into a polling booth as a voter, and you put your thumbprint into the ink pad, and then you put it onto a ballot. And then the ballots are then counted by hand, typically afterwards. Also, the voter accreditation process is a critical piece of this. There's been a lot of fraud around voters' cards in the past, people saying who they are and not. I've seen children lined up to vote in parts of the country who had legitimate voting cards saying that they were 30, 40 years old. Mm. So these sorts of things are common and something that the Electoral Commission is trying to crack down on.
What percentage of people who are eligible to vote actually do vote in Nigeria?
Well, this is a big source of debate. The electoral vote counts in the past have been probably far, far more inflated than they really have been. I'd say in the past we see 50 to 60% voter turnout in some of the highly contested areas, but yet you'll see 80 to 90% recorded on the official ballots.
So still a lot of corruption going on.
Absolutely. I think what we're going to see is probably a fairly good picture on the ground at the voting booth in many parts of the country. And then we're going to see a tremendous amount of competitive rigging on the parts of both parties overnight and into the next day as the numbers move up the coalition chain, as the parties try to push things in their own directions.
Why do you do this? Why is this so important to you?
I've been watching Nigeria for 20 years now. This election in particular is going to be a pivotal one. For the first time, Nigeria has an opposition party that looks like it might actually have the strength on the ground to unseat the ruling party. In the regional high flyers like Ghana and other success stories, the key turning point in their political development has been the rise of a viable political opposition, which gives voters a real choice. And Nigeria is at that point right now for the first time. And so this is going to be historic.
That's Darren Kew, the executive director of the Center for Peace, Democracy, and Development at the University of Massachusetts Boston. He is part of an international team that's going to be monitoring the elections in Nigeria this Saturday. We spoke to him right before he left.
French prisons have been in the spotlight since the terrorist attacks in Paris back in January. That's when 17 people were killed in an attack on the offices of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo. Authorities believe that one of the suspects in the case became radicalized when he served time in prison. So now the French government is moving forward with measures designed to counter radicalism inside French jails. The BBC's Lucy Williamson reports.
French prisons have been seen as jihadi recruitment centres for years, but the terrorist attacks here in January, the worst in living memory, shed new light on the threat these networks could pose to France. Karim Mokhtari was the target of one such recruiter. A Muslim convert serving time for assault and armed robbery, Karim says the recruiter urged him to join a radical network. "I wasn't convinced," Karim told me, "but some people were." Part of the problem, he says, was the lack of Muslim guidance inside the jail.
For more than 5 years in prison, I didn't once meet a Muslim chaplain, and that lack of chaplains is an open door for self-proclaimed imams in prison to spread radical discourse.
To prevent the prison system churning out any more jihadists, the government is stepping in to train imams in the Republic's secular values and send more of them into the nation's prisons. Thomas Andreu is head of public liberties at the Interior Ministry.
France is a secular state. We're not going to tell people what Islam looks like or should look like. But we certainly have a role in the training of imams. Many of them come from abroad, and many of them are not familiar with French culture. And so the French government is starting to provide training about French law, French society, and that is going to bear fruit.
As well as training imams and providing more chaplains for prison guidance, the government is expanding a new project to separate jihadists within the nation's jails. But former inmate and prison convert Karim Mokhtari says that's a terrible idea.
The attacks in January created an emergency situation, and the authorities have responded with emergency solutions. The thinking is they won't be able to convert other inmates if they're separated from the rest. But it will be down to prison staff to determine who is showing signs of radicalization, and they're not equipped to do that. It's difficult. Some are very radical, others are not.
The government admits the separating of prisoners is an emergency measure and that prison radicalization has been a long-standing problem. The question then is why so little has been done to tackle it when researchers like Professor Andrew Hussey have been writing about it for years.
I think the French security services have been looking in the wrong direction. They've always feared the movement of terrorism from one side of the Mediterranean to another, and they've not really taken into account that the borders are very porous and it's already been taking place within the French prison system.
The extent to which French Islam is influenced by the state's secular values or the values of imams from abroad is a sensitive political debate. But it's one that's now taking place not only in mosques, but in the state's own heavily guarded institutions.
That's the BBC's Lucy Williamson in France. You're listening to Here and Now.
The film While We're Young is in theaters tomorrow. It comes from writer-director Noah Baumbach, who often combines comedy and drama in his work, probably most notably in his 2005 film The Squid and the Whale. That film told the story of a divorce through the eyes of the children. His new film, While We're Young, is mostly a comedy, though at times it can be hard to watch. Ben Stiller plays a 40-something documentary filmmaker. He and his wife, played by Naomi Watts, live a reasonably contented, child-free life in New York, something that their friends envy.
We're the boring couple with a baby. What have you guys been doing? Tell us something fun.
Oh, we met this interesting couple, Jamie and Darby. He's a young documentarian, and she makes ice cream.
I don't know what to make of them, honestly. I like her.
They make everything. It's infectious. For about 12 hours, I thought I could build my own desk.
There's something about being around them that energizes you, you know?
How old are they?
25, 26.
26, 27.
They're children.
While We're Young opens in theaters tomorrow. Noah Baumbach joins us from New York. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And where did the idea for this film come from?
Well, I'd been toying with an idea. I wanted to write about couples and about a married couple in particular. It was something I started sort of after I finished Squid and the Whale, and then I abandoned it. And more recently, it came together, I think, just when I was also – I turned 40, and I was sort of thinking about making that sort of obvious to everyone else but revelatory to me realization that I was no longer 25.
Was that a scary thing for you?
No, it's not scary, but it's maybe can be startling, I suppose, to sort of, you know, realize, you know, everybody has that thing of, wow, was that really? That was 20 years ago? You know, those kind of thoughts.
Well, and in this case, you've got this couple, Josh and Cornelia, played by Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts, and they meet this young couple that I guess seems like a younger version of themselves, and they try to keep up with these younger friends. Ben Stiller tries biking, ends up hurting himself, and goes to the doctor's office, and I want to hear a clip from what happens next.
Well, it's just a strained muscle, but the more concerning thing here is your arthritis.
Arthritis?
Yes, you have arthritis in your knee.
Is arthritis a catch-all for some kind of injury to the...
No, arthritis is a degradation of the joints.
Yeah, I know what traditional arthritis is, but...
I'm not sure what you mean by traditional, but this is arthritis.
Arthritis? Arthritis?
Yes. I usually just say it once.
He seems to be in denial for a large portion of the movie about the fact that he is aging, like everybody does.
Well, I don't know that he's in total denial, but he's... You know, it's that thing where you're like, well, I'm not old enough to have arthritis. It's got to be some other version of it, you know, that feeling that these things are only things that happen to you when you get older, and then realizing that you're actually older.
You know, the other thing about that clip that I think I found watching the movie is that you and you've done this in your other films, bring this humor along with pain. You know, mm-hmm. you see the darker side of what's going on, but at the same time, it's funny.
Yeah, and I always think I'm making a comedy pretty much every time out, but sometimes the tone of the movie shifts in ways that I'm both in control of and out of control of. But with this movie, I really saw it in a kind of comic tradition of movies, you know, about marriages, comedies of remarriage, you know, even, you know, dating back to 30s and 40s screwball comedies. And it felt connected for me even to movies from, you know, the 80s when I was an adolescent, things like Tootsie and Working Girl and Broadcast News. They're character driven. You know, they're not so much concept driven. They're really about people, you know, and that's what I really responded to about them. I mean, is they can be broadly funny, but they're also, you know, they're moving. They're kind of about our experience.
One of the other things that you do in this film is you at least seem to be taking some pot shots at the culture of modern technology, that we are all relying on our phones and on Facebook and on whatever else. Is that something you have a problem with personally?
Well, I don't – I mean, technology is obviously, you know, a great thing. But I do – you know, part of my work is writing, and one of the place where I do this work is connected to this endless sinkhole of distraction. And then it's also now something I carry around with me. I mean, I think these distractions are something I'm constantly at war with. Mm. And it was – you know, it was interesting to me to think of – the generations who didn't grow up with this technology now being stuck with it and being addicted to it. And, you know, we have fun with that in the movie.
Well, do you disconnect when you're writing? Do you try to at any?
I try to, yeah, I do. It's difficult, as I'm sure you know.
Well, and actually one of the really interesting moments in this film is there's a question people want to know the answer to, and Ben Stiller's character says, oh, well, I'll just Google it. And they say, no, don't do that. Don't Google
right.
it. And
let's just not know what it is.
Yeah, let's not know what it is. Let's actually just not know what it is. What an interesting concept now. Why would anybody do that?
Well, that's a kind of observation in the movie that the younger generation who – you know, has grown up with all of this technology, in some ways I think has the freedom to indulge in more analog, either analog technology, but also even analog ideas. I mean, like that, you know, that's coming from the 20-year-old, from Adam Driver's character saying, let's just not know what it is. That's a concept that maybe the Ben and Naomi's characters have forgotten.
One more thing I want to ask you about here is another theme, which is the idea of truth telling and being true. I mean, this is a film about documentary filmmakers, and they have a debate about how truthful you really have to be when you're telling a story in a documentary. Mm-hmm. This is happening. This movie is coming out at the time that we've had this show, The Jinx, on HBO, which just led to the arrest of Robert Durst, who's now accused of murder in several cases because of a confession that he made on that show, which wasn't shared with the public until it aired. Do you have a problem with things like that, with taking the opportunity for greater drama in order to get a bigger audience or whatever the case may be?
Well, I mean, I think it depends, I suppose, on the circumstances and the filmmaker, the movie, the subject. I mean, there are many arguments and questions that come up in this movie, both about technology and about, as you were saying, truth in documentary or truth in art. And I felt like my responsibility really was to bring a kind of conclusion and a satisfying, hopeful conclusion to the story of the marriage, but that these other arguments were things that I was going to engage in sort of via the characters, but not be able to solve and, you know, leave for debate after the movie if that should happen.
Well, as a filmmaker, how constrained do you feel by sticking to the truth? Obviously, you're doing a dramatic film here. You don't have to do it in the way that a documentary filmmaker might. But we've just had this debate over films like Selma and American Sniper. How closely do they have to stick to the truth when it's a film about something that actually happened?
Well, I mean, I get the question every movie I make. I'm asked about the autobiography because I generate these movies myself, and they're very personal in nature, although I would say they're not particularly autobiographical. My feeling is, from as a audience member, is, you know, I feel like it's psychological truth that I'm looking for in a movie, you know, that if it feels right. I mean, obviously you can do anything you want in a movie, and, you know, it's like, why is a unhappy ending sometimes the most satisfying ending? Because it feels right. It feels true, even if it's not technically a happy ending.
Noah Baumbach, before I let you go, let's go back to what we were talking about at the beginning. This is a movie about people who are getting into middle age. You've now got a few years into your 40s anyway. Do you feel better about it? Are you more at ease with it than you were when you went? What do they say over the hill at 40? That seems so young to be over the hill, but
let's not say that.
Okay.
Yeah, I feel, I don't know if I feel at ease. I feel about as at ease as I've ever felt. And when I was in my 20s, I think I was probably at my most panicked. I felt like life was moving too quickly. I hadn't done enough. I felt real urgency in a way that, you know, in retrospect seems pointless. But I think there's a lot good about middle age.
That's Noah Baumbach, whose new film opens tomorrow. It's called While We're Young. Noah Baumbach, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This year marks the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II, and some veterans of that conflict are embarking on one more mission to return Japanese flags American GIs took as souvenirs from the battlefield. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, Tom Bonsi reports.
Back in World War II, Woodburn, Oregon's Buck Wetherell fought across the beaches and jungles of Southeast Asia with the U.S. Army's 41st Infantry. After one bloody engagement late in the war, he says he and his comrades looked for souvenirs on the battlefield.
It was on a dead Japanese soldier. The flag was on his pocket and sticking out, and I took it off him.
The flag Wetherell picked up measured about 3 feet by 2 feet. Calligraphy bedecked the white spaces around the red center, personal messages from the soldier's family and friends. This kind of decorated flag was traditionally presented to a Japanese serviceman prior to his deployment. As a war prize, it was so common, Americans gave it the name a good luck flag. 70 years pass. Buck Wetherell is now 93 years old. At the suggestion of his daughters, he decided to try to return the captured memento to the dead soldier's family.
I just thought, you know, the war's over, we're not enemies anymore, we're friends, and they should get the flag back.
And they did. And they're not the only ones. Japanese consulates in the U.S. have gotten dozens of inquiries from American veterans or their wives and children asking how to return war memorabilia. And now a nonprofit has sprung up. A Japanese-American couple from Nacelle, Washington, Rex and Keiko Zeke, co-founded the group Obon 2015 to facilitate the return of flags.
Each one is, in most cases, the last surviving trace of that one individual. And back home are wives, children, brothers and sisters who lost that person and nothing ever came back.
The Zeke send the inscribed flags back with help from Japan. Scholars, government ministry workers, a veterans group, and an association of Shinto priests pore over high-resolution digital scans for clues. Rex Zeke compares the task to identifying the owner of a yearbook from the notes scribbled inside the cover 7 decades later.
So I'm honored now very much to introduce a veteran of the 41st Signal Company, Mr.
Earlier this week, the Zeeks organized what they called a returning ceremony, their first stateside.
My mother and I present this Yusaki Hinamaru to the Japanese people and hopefully to its return. I promise I wasn't going to do this.
The emotional scene played out at the old train depot in Astoria, Oregon, where once troops bound for the Pacific Theater shipped out. World War II vets or sons and daughters like Jerry Bassett there and Elaine Locke turned over 5 flags.
It's difficult to let go of it, and it's one of the few things I have left of my father. But if it were his and I lost him in a war, I would want it back.
Keiko Zeke wiped away tears as she accepted the flags. It brings the number her nonprofit has received to nearly 100. Of those, original owners' families have been identified for about 25.
Thank you.
According to Keiko, the reappearance of these flags after such a long time provokes a wide range of reactions among relatives of the fallen.
In Japan side, they are shocked because they don't know that still exists to return to their family. So they're just so shocked. And then secondly, they feel that their father or the brother coming back home. So they feel so attached and overwhelmed. Very, very powerful spiritual and meaningful.
Hiroshi Furusawa is the Japanese Consul General in Portland. He told the Americans at the returning ceremony that they were doing a wonderful and honorable thing.
Your courage, their courage, did not end on the battlefield, but extends to this very day and beyond. in the joy and profound emotional healing you help to bring to families in Japan.
Several other speakers said the gesture of reconciliation is not just about a flag. They said the flag carries the spirit of its long-gone owner, home. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bontsi in Astoria, Oregon.
And from returned Japanese flags to perhaps the most famous flag in World War II, the American flag planted at the Battle of Iwo Jima, a battle that ended 70 years ago this week. There were 27 medals of honor awarded for bravery during Iwo Jima. One of them went to Jack Lucas, who threw his body on two grenades and saved the lives of several other Marines. He spoke with us in 2006.
I saw the two grenades. I rammed my rifle into one and fell over on it and pulled the other grenade, grabbed it with my right hand, pulled it underneath me, and immediately exploded and blew me over my back, puncturing my right lung, shrapnel in both shoulders and chest, side, right thigh, and I never lost consciousness.
Jack Lucas, who survived his wounds, but more than 6,000 Americans died on Iwo Jima. Lucas died in 2008 in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. He was 80 years old. And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now.